The Queen's Jewish Link presents the Jewish Living Podcast, the show that examines the many facets of Orthodox Jewish life. Here's your host, Izzo Zwirin.
Machlokas is something ingrained into our society. We fight over issues in our communities, our religion, and God knows, our politics. I don't really know what society was like before I was born, but it seems like the advent of social media has enhanced machlokas in today's discourse. So this week I invited on someone who spends much of his time trying to break down machlokas and promote shalom.
Hi, my name is Rabbi Daniel Cohen, the senior rabbi of Congregation Agudah Shalom in Stamford, Connecticut, and author of What Will They Say About You When You're Gone? Creating a Life of Legacy.
Rabbi Cohen and I will discuss the various areas where he has helped bridge divides, whether it be in shul, his community, or even interfaith.
All right, Rabbi Cohen, thank you so much for joining me this week. I'm going to be full disclosure about this right up front. Rabbi Cohen here is my brother's father-in-law. We've known each other for now about a year and a half or so, but I'm very excited to have him on the show. Aside from my wife, you are the closest, I guess, quote-unquote relative that I've had on the show, and I welcome you into the world of the Jewish Living Podcast.
Well, it's an honor to be here, and I feel a special kinship with you. I've rarely been interviewed by a family member, so this is really nice.
All right, thank you so much. And Rabbi Cohen, if you can give us a little bit of a background, I know you're the Rav in Stamford. If you can give a little some background about you, how you got to the position, and maybe a little bit about your adventures that you're going into right now.
Sure. So I've been serving as the rabbi at Agudah Shalom, a very large modern Orthodox synagogue in Stamford, Connecticut, for about 16 years. And originally hailed from Atlanta, where I had my formative years, and it's certainly very relevant to my mission as a rabbi, which is really fostering a community that is certainly rooted in Orthodoxy, but very inclusive, very diverse. You know, we like to consider Stamford to be an out-of-town community close to New York. And we don't really care how people get there as long as they're kind of coming, and try to help people, no matter where they are in the spectrum of spiritual growth, find a gateway for connection. So we love being here. Thank God a lot of people have been moving in more recently. And it's just a wonderful opportunity to really try to create what I think is a little bit of a minority these days, which is a very heterogeneous Orthodox synagogue. Not looking to create a synagogue in anybody's image, but in God's image. And that means welcoming everybody of all backgrounds. And I spent a lot of my time not only trying to nurture that diversity, which, by the way, I have to give really, really wonderful credit to the rabbi who was here for about 50 years, Rabbi Joseph Ehrenkrantz. He came in 1947. He served as the rabbi for almost 50 years. And he was a very embracing figure. And that's really the spirit of our shul that I continue to try to build on. Most importantly, also, thank God, a father of six daughters, one of whom was married to your brother.
That's right.
Which is great. A couple grandsons, three girls made Aliyah. So we spend a lot of time certainly in Connecticut, New York area, but also have our hearts in Israel as well.
Phenomenal. And that introduction to your shul is a great way to transition into what our topic is this week, and that is how to make peace. So if you're bringing a lot of different groups together or perceived groups together into your shul, I want to explore a little bit of how you apply that, maybe not just within your shul, but within the greater community. And the reason that I thought of you for this particular episode was when you made, I guess in Connecticut, it was local news. If you didn't live in Stamford, then maybe you haven't heard about this, but you guys had a little bit of a local election for mayor where you were heavily involved with, I guess, crafting how the campaigns were to go. And for those sports fans out there, one of the candidates was a former Mets manager, Bobby Valentine, who I believe was not wearing his fake mustache during this at any point. But if you could talk a little bit about what you were able to accomplish with the two candidates.
You know, this, I would say, goes with the overall spirit of at least the way I see my rabbinate, and also those who, you know, I think about Rabbi Riskin, and he should live and be well. He once said, my job is not to be an Orthodox rabbi, but a rabbi to the Jewish people and beyond. And when Hashem speaks to Abraham, he says that the role of the Jewish people is v'nivrachu b'cha kol mishpachot ha'adama, that all the families of the earth should be blessed through us. So my role is really to take the timeless principles of Judaism and help reveal light wherever it is, both in the Jewish world and in the non-Jewish world. So I happen to be close with both individuals that were running for mayor, both the Democratic and Republican candidate. Carolyn Simmons served in the state house, and she's a good friend and really a good heart. And Bobby Valentine is somebody that I've grown close to because I used to play for the New York Mets many years ago. Just kidding. Anyway, I got to know him. You know, he's a man about town, and you know, we've chatted, and I know them both to be good people. So I think, as everybody, we've all been frustrated by the divisiveness in politics, the polarization, the inability for people to move outside of their own ideological point of view to appreciate the view of another. And we're living in a very, again, black and white world. And unfortunately, that leads to not only disagreements, but demonization of people. So when Caroline Simmons won the primary, she was running actually against the incumbent mayor. The next day on the front page of the Stanford Advocate, I saw a nice smiley picture of her. And one of her delegates was maligning the character of Bobby Valentine. And I said, this is ridiculous. That's not the kind of person who she is. And that's not the kind of person that Bobby Valentine is, to be the recipient of that sort of negativity. So I decided, rather than just stay on the sidelines, I would try to craft a principles for leading a positive campaign. It was right around Sukkot time. And I reached out to both candidates and explained to them my vision and my dream that maybe moving forward, and it took a while to get there because a lot of them would say, and they did, like, it's too late. It's already out of the bag. You know, there's no way really to control it, to say, look, let's try to embrace these principles moving forward. It's good for you. It's good for the city of Stanford. So over the course of the few weeks, you know, I was able to get both of them to sign the document. Unfortunately, though, I would say, even though their heart might have been in it, it's very difficult to ensure that those who represent them also embrace those values. And it becomes very complicated as far as the different people that are proxies for them. So I think that it was a good faith effort. People appreciated the fact that I tried, but it was also in the middle of a campaign and difficult really to monitor. But I don't believe that it was something that was not worthwhile as an effort, as potentially something at the beginning of a campaign. Because again, I only did it in the middle of a campaign, but really moving forward is maybe something for campaigns all across the country to embrace in the future as well.
And it's more of a scout's honor type thing. It's not like, oh, we're putting in place like punishments in case you don't do this. It's
right. So they asked me about that. Like, how are you going to hold people accountable? I said, look, my role is not to be the referee. I'm here to help people aspire to becoming the best version of themselves. And people took it with that spirit as well.
I remember back in the 2020 presidential race, which was not a very nice race, let's put it that way. There was a, I believe it was either Nevada or Arizona, where there were two gubernatorial candidates that basically ran a campaign ad together on the same screen. And they said, I'm this guy and I'm this guy, and we are opposing on these issues, but we're not going to oppose each other as people, because we both agree that each other are nice people, and we're not going to do that. We're going to try to run a positive campaign. And that reminded me of what you tried to do in Stanford. And do I know that? I didn't follow that case. I don't live in whatever state that was. I don't even know which state it was at this point. But I don't know if that led to anything positive coming out. I don't know if there were negative, but just seeing that there are people out there that are thinking about these things to make maybe even just the most divisive topics a little nicer, a little kinder, really helps me to appreciate that, you know, maybe not all is lost in this country and especially on the political sphere.
Yeah, I would say, look, I mean, you know, the Torah and Judaism is really here to serve as a counterintuitive force within society. Society's tendency is, again, to look at people one-dimensionally, to demonize people, to create, again, disagreements that become disagreeable. And if you look at the model, and I share this with the candidates, if you look at the Talmud, it's probably one of the most debated, one of the most documents in all of human history that has more debates back and forth, constant arguments. Yet the Talmud tells us that the children of Beit Shammai marry the children of Beit Hillel. Today, somebody would say to their child, you never bring home a Democrat or never bring home a Republican. I don't want to see that kind of person in my house. And the Torah is reminding us that, you know, that is a very, not only immature, but very shallow way of looking at who human beings are. So we as Jews never lose faith in making the world a better place. It's not our job, as it says in Ethics of Our Fathers, to finish the task, but we still have to start and do whatever we can.
All right. And we're going to transition a little bit out of politics, a little bit back towards religion, because as popular as this illustrious show that we're on right now is, you have your own show, maybe even two that I'm not, I was trying to figure this out. But I know you have a show, The Rabbi and the Reverend.
That's correct.
And I want to know, talk, if you could talk a little bit about, do you also have your own show, like your own individual show?
I got a lot of shows. No, it's funny. Somebody's trying to start like another podcast with me. But the main thing is The Rabbi and the Reverend, which has been going on for about 5-6 years, and it's syndicated on a number of different markets: Chicago, Cleveland, Florida, different places around the country. But it's interesting. I mean, that started, and I think this really relates to how do we build peace and bridges. It started with a friendship. It wasn't like, for example, I said I want to engage in this major dialogue with somebody of a different faith. The way it started was Reverend Dahl, who was the, at that time, assistant pastor in the Roten Presbyterian Church in Darien, which is the largest Presbyterian church in New England. He wanted to know if he could bring his confirmation class to our shul to experience what it meant to go to a synagogue. And he had previously gone to the conservative synagogue in Greenwich, but I guess he decided he wanted to try an Orthodox synagogue. So I responded to him. I still remember, I said, look, before we do that, I'd love to meet you. Let's get together for coffee. And basically we bonded over our love of college basketball. He went to University of Kentucky. He actually played wide receiver in college, but we were both big Wildcat fans. And I talked to him about Kyle Macy. Now, I don't know as if you know who Kyle Macy was.
I do not.
He was a guard in the 1970s for when Kentucky won, was in the Final Four. And his hair was always coiffed in a perfect way. It was perfect black hair. So the Reverend pulls out a picture of Kyle Macy now, and he's bald. And that brought us together. So I brought him he came to the synagogue. We're basically about the same age. Our wives and I have gone, we've all gone out to dinner together at the kosher restaurant, celebrated his birthday together. And then we decided to pool our common effort together to focus on just doing kindness in the world. And the Elijah moment, which is something that I write about, it was covered by a radio station. And then they asked us if we wanted to start our own radio show. That was about 6-7 years ago. And that's how the whole thing evolved. But I'm always amazed at how we definitely, obviously, are different faiths, but there's so much more that unites us than divides us. And when you have a friendship together and you realize that he's doing it in his way and I'm doing it in my way, but we're both here to try to counsel people, to give people faith, to help them be good parents, good spouses, not lose hope in just making the world better, we find that there's a lot that unites us. And certainly we talk about the differences, but I find that we recognize that we're all created in God's image and just trying to help reveal the divine within ourselves and within the world around us.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I know you, I believe that you also lead an interfaith Bible study class in your shul or?
No, not in my shul.
Not in your shul.
No, but I lead a couple of them. And it's funny. It's not, you know, it's funny because this is the way it happens. It's not that, okay, let me get together and just do an interfaith group. There's a couple people, you know, in Greenwich in particular, that have friends that are spiritual, some Jewish, some not Jewish. And it just evolved where they said, you know, they love to have me teach. So I just teach about, you know, timeless lessons within the Torah, basically, about how to improve their lives. And like you do, I want to make it practical. It's not filled with ideological debates about the divinity of the Torah, who's a real prophet. It's more about what can we learn from the stories about relationships, about gratitude, about honesty, about impact, and all those 13 attributes that we try to emulate that God brings into the world, into our lives.
All right. And so we spoke about the politics, we spoke about the interfaith. Now, the last piece of this for you is going to, in my mind, is going to be you as a Rav of a shul, where I'm sure that you have to deal with interpersonal relationships, issues that your congregants might have, communal issues. So I want to get a little bit of a sense of how you approach giving advice to your congregants, to your friends, to your family, on how to overcome some of the natural machlokas that might exist within day-to-day life.
It doesn't exist. Just kidding.
I got scared there for like a half a second. Like, oh, this whole episode is going to be a bad one.
That was like a half a second delay. No, yeah. That's fine. You know, I think intellectually, a lot of people recognize that the Talmud, the Mishnah, guides us to see the positive in people. You know, it says that, right, Dana kol ha'adam l'kav zchut, judge everyone favorably. And one of the Mefarshim points out, it says kol ha'adam, which means there's always going to be something about somebody that I don't like, but don't look at that only that one thing. You know, a tendency in life is like, right, the missing tile syndrome. Everything is great, but all you can focus is on the missing tile on the roof. And if I disagree with somebody about something, the tendency is I focus only on the differences. But the reality is we look at kol ha'adam, we begin to understand that people are much more complex. We can't judge people until we're in their place. And the truth is we're never in their place. So I would say that one of the most important strategies to cultivate peace among a diverse constituency is, again, bringing people together socially, creating friendships, helping people really begin to understand a little bit that people are just not, you know, one-note people, one-dimensional people. And it gets tougher, by the way, as synagogues grow and as there are varying demographics, people begin to look at people in groups. And that's very anti-Jewish. You know, everybody is a soul in and of themselves. And we, for example, in our shul have intergenerational Shabbat dinners together. We call them rookies and vets, where we bring people together, maybe only been there 5 years, and people that have been there for 25 years, just to share Shabbat together. Find ways for them to focus on doing good within the community. And I would say as a rabbi, and this also takes a lot of time, but that's really what being a rabbi is all about and being a human being, is people really don't care how much you know. They want to know how much you care. And that was a line from my mentor, Rabbi Stephen Dworkin, a blessed memory. And if we build a community that is rooted in chesed and kindness and warmth and hospitality and friendship, non-judgmental. That's, by the way, a word that you hear a lot in Stanford. I love it because it's non-judgmental. You know, I don't really care what your own personal observance is. I know you're on your own growth path. Then that cultivates a community of acceptance, warmth, and inclusion. And even though I may disagree with you about certain things, that's not a reason for me to dismiss you. I would say that as a rabbi of a shul, it's really important that I don't bring politics per se in terms of endorsements of candidates or policies. You know, half my synagogue is Republican, half my synagogue is Democrat.
Sounds like
standard. But I talk about issues and values, and people appreciate that because at the end of the day, we want to transcend those differences and focus on the 80% that binds us together and not the 20% that divides us.
So that is a phenomenal way of looking at it from a communal perspective. I want to get a little bit of differentiated situations. So from a communal perspective, yes, I especially like the idea of people want to know, not necessarily how much you know, but how much you care. I want to give you a couple of other areas where people,
sure.
So we're recording this right before Thanksgiving. So there's going to be, we're unfortunately not going to be able to release it before Thanksgiving, but there's other holidays coming up in the future. So people get together with family. There's going to be a lot of time spent together. There's potentially area for whenever a family gets together that they haven't seen for a while, a lot of, you know, love and affection, but there's also areas where you can get into, let's say, rousing conversation that could lead to other things. I don't think there's anybody's family who's immune to these types of arguments. What can people do to not necessarily avoid the confrontations, but maybe have them in a way that doesn't leave people with a bad taste in their mouth when they leave?
I do think that it's challenging to even move into the area of having a political conversation these days that doesn't get all heated. I mean, especially when it comes to family members that aren't together a lot. So we have no idea where people are at. So all of a sudden at your Thanksgiving dinner or wherever it is, you start engaging in, what do you think of this politician's policies? In the end of the day, you're not going to solve the policies. You're not going to end up agreeing on it. So I actually do think that it's important to create sacred space at family get-togethers. If you think it might lead to potentially, you know, divisiveness and not necessarily just a debate about ideologies, then it is probably important just to not even bring it up at that point in time. So I do think boundaries are important. I do think, though, that it's also possible, and I think to use the time together, the easy thing to do many times is to take a family get together and just start talking about the news and the politics and divisive things. And we try to do this at our Shabbat table sometimes, which is before you come to your Thanksgiving table or your Hanukkah party, maybe think about what are the topics that you do want to talk about so that you can actually put it out there, like an interesting ethical dilemma. Or we at one of our Shabbos tables to try to get people to know each other and just say, share with me a powerful memory when you were in Israel, period. Just something that's uplifting and gets people to know each other a little more, as opposed to the least common denominator, which is what did you binge watch on TV? What did CNN or Fox say? You know, that doesn't necessarily move the relationships forward. All it does is create more potential conflict.
That's right. Well, I'll also point out that in this politically charged environment that we live in, like often the major arguments might around family gatherings focus around politics, but there's other areas that even in the concepts that you were talking about might elicit some of these other areas where families might fight. There's money involved. There's, I don't like the way you're treating this person. There's those types of, I'm going to call them benign arguments because they don't really affect anybody outside of your individual family circle. But they're still there. And those are the topics that, yeah, you can get into fights about politics, but if you get into fights about something that really affects the fabric of the family, the fabric of the cohesiveness of the family, those might have a bigger chance to explode.
Right. So I think that, again, it comes back down to the depth of the relationship and the appreciation of, you know, each individual within the family. I was talking to somebody about this recently who is having an issue with somebody that they're working with. And I said, 8 out of your 10 communications with this person must be positive. And then the 2 that are negative will kind of be mitigated a little bit. But if the only time you're communicating with that person is because you have something to complain about or you don't like, don't even bring it up. You're never going to win. So I would use that as a guideline for the family. Like, we can talk about things that are challenging, but just make sure that 9 out of 10 are positive. And if you haven't done the first 9, then don't talk about the other one.
All right. So that's family. Now let's go break that down to even the smaller relationship, and that's spousal. I don't want to get into a huge conversation about it. We've done man, wife, husband, wife, male, female relationships on the show before. But if you can give me maybe 1 or 2 points that you might have an advice for married couples out there in order to either avoid tremendous conflict or quell existing conflicts that might persist in a relationship.
Wow, you loaded this one up. look, I think that being very appreciative is definitely a key in Shalom Bayit. You know, nobody wants to feel they're taken for granted. And sometimes we're kinder to the stranger than we are to the person who's sitting right in front of us. And it's just a constant reminder. I mean, Judaism teaches us that as well. We don't just say in the morning, thanks God for everything. There's a bracha for every little blessing that we have. So I think being very intentional in a relationship about thanking one's spouse for all the little things that they do, to me, is a key component to Shalom Bayit. The other thing is anticipating opportunities to support the other one, or it's acts of kindness, spontaneous, you know, I wouldn't say spontaneous because it's not that you're not thinking about it, but I think it's showing the other spouse that they really are the center of your life. You know, one of the challenges oftentimes is that, you know, relationships, there are a few cases, God forbid, maybe it was cheating or physical or verbal abuse, where a relationship can just literally crash in a moment. Most relationships are either building or dying one decision at a time, one comment at a time. You know, when a person puts something out of their mouth, at that point, it's the word that controls the person. It's no longer the person that controls the word. And many times if a person, God forbid, gets angry or impatient or says something, it's irreparable. Now, it doesn't mean that it can't be healed, but I do think that being very careful with the words that come out of our mouth, only using words that will build, not that will divide or diminish, recognizing the good that people do, finding ways to anticipate acts of kindness in the marriage, to me are all important ways to increase the shalom. The other thing I would say, and this is a reminder more so I would say to the men, is just, you know, I was talking with the groom today, and you know, the Rambam says and others that one of the obligations of a husband towards a wife is giving them time, being a good listener. Not always easy to listen well, but that to me is really important because that shows that we really care.
So when you're sitting down to dinner with your spouse, don't have the phones out, put them away. Have a conversation, take the phone out as soon as dinner is done.
Well, I would say that's also why I'm a big fan of trying to take walks with children, with spouses, because the phone just stay at home. And it's very difficult to kind of check a phone, even if you had it, to pull it out of your pocket. You just put it away. We're taking a 30-minute walk, and it enables people really just to be more centered around each other.
Okay, that could be with a spouse, or that could be with the with kids, family,
100%,
whoever.
Yeah.
Awesome. I want to shift slightly to a topic that's still about relationships, but has a whole different set of issues that come with it. And that is in business, whether you are an employee, an employer, a partner. Do you have any advice for people that might be struggling with relationships at the office?
I would say to a certain degree, it goes back to what I said with family. You know, I was talking and going back to this person who was struggling with somebody they were working with. I said, have you spent any social time together? Have you gone out for lunch together? Because again, if all your interactions are around decisions, business, it's very difficult to be forgiving and understanding because it's all about the bottom line. But if somebody really takes the time, and that's why a lot of companies do this, you develop a retreat, you go out together, you spend social time together, you're building a friendship, and then you're much more inclined to see the person in a positive light and give them the benefit of the doubt and not see them just as another cog in the wheel of the company that you're in. I do think it's also important that any company or business has a statement of values and principles through which everybody is clear as to who we are and what we stand for. Sometimes when a person has a moral dilemma or decision, unless they have a clear prism through which to make that decision, they end up feeling a lot of pressure to either compromise or make a decision, you know, based on who the highest bidder is. But if everyone in the company is aligned with what the mission is and what the values are, I do think it minimizes conflict. And there's a certain degree of mutual expectation as to what we should be expecting from each other and how we should be treating each other.
That's phenomenal. I love that. Before I let you talk about your various ventures that you're dealing with right now, or that you're starting or continuing. Do you have any more advice that we didn't cover? Any other relationships that you might think need to be discussed?
I would say one, which you missed. I'm surprised.
Oh, no.
Making peace with God.
Oh, that's, you know what? When I put this the concepts together based on interpersonal relationships, and it's hard to have an interpersonal relationship with a non-personal entity. So yeah, yes, absolutely.
I guess what I mean by that is that, I mean, a lot of the Hasidim talk about this, and the mystics, that nobody's perfect. And we all have things in life that we regret. And sometimes that pulls us away, of course, from our relationship with God. And we might think that, you know, we're not necessarily worthy of moving forward or continuing with different mitzvot and getting up when we've fallen down. But having peace with God means recognizing that a few things. The more that we spend regretting things that we did, every moment is a moment wasted to rebuilding the relationship and doing something positive. And that's something that sometimes we all fall prey to, where we're just kind of, I wish I should have shown up to Minion more. I should have put it down this. Okay, accept it and now move forward. Because when Hashem gives us life in the morning, He's saying today is a new day. I mean, the Orach Chaim talks about this based upon the writings of Rabbi Isaac Luria, that every day there's something unique for us to accomplish, which we cannot have accomplished yesterday and we can't accomplish tomorrow. So for me on this day right now to think about yesterday, it's too late. And all I'm doing is taking away opportunities to make this day a great day. So I think when we have that mindset, we should realize that it's not only important to believe in God, but to remember that God believes in us. God loves us. He wants us to accomplish something special, and that's a way for us to create a little more shleimut, peace in our relationship with God.
That's phenomenal. So like I promised before, let's talk about let's talk about your book. First of all, let's say the title again, and where can people get it?
Okay, so the book is called What Will They Say About You When You're Gone? Creating a Life of Legacy. You can get it on Amazon, of course, or on my website, RabbiDanielCohen.com. And the premise, just briefly, behind the book is you're at a funeral, and as you walk out of the funeral, you have a moment when you say to yourself, I hope they speak about me the way they spoke about that person. Regardless of your faith, we feel we want to do more with life. And then usually we're motivated for about 15 minutes until we get a text, an email, and then we go back to life as usual.
Hits so hard.
I'm sorry.
That hits so hard.
So the idea behind the book is I help people identify what is the kind of life that you want to lead? What is the version of your best self? And then I take them on a journey of 7 principles to reverse engineer their lives so they lead the lives now for how they want to be remembered.
Phenomenal. And your radio show?
Yeah, so the radio show, you can just type in the Rabbi and the Reverend and type in my name or Reverend Greg Dahl. You can listen to the shows there. It's not yet in the New York market, but it's on Sundays in Chicago and Cleveland and Tampa Bay and a host of other markets, and also on podcasts. You can pick that up. And we're also right now, I encourage people during Thanksgiving and beyond, we're starting a campaign. I mentioned before the words Elijah moment, which is one of the principles in the book. The idea behind the Elijah moment is we may not be able to change the world, but each and every one of us can change the world of one person. No encounter is random. And as the Baal Shem Tov said, you know, we may be the Elijah that the world is waiting for. Maybe you're waiting online in a supermarket and somebody needs your help, or you pay for somebody's coffee and pay it forward. I'll give you a story, you know, that I think about a lot. I was in Philadelphia at a train station, and I look like a generous guy, I guess. And a guy says to me, would you mind buying me dinner? So I said to him, how about Dunkin' Donuts? And he said to me, I'd rather have the Cajun food over there. I said, that's fine. So I paid for the Cajun food. And I said to him, what's your name? He said, his name is Sam. And I said, God bless you, Sam. And then he turned to me and said, God has already blessed me. He sent me you. And God doesn't put us in a situation unless there's something positive that we can do with the person that we meet. And these opportunities are endless and infinite. So we in Stanford, and I encourage you wherever you are, Thanksgiving or beyond, are spending the morning going to our local police department, fire department, and EMS, bringing them cards, bringing them cookies, and saying thank you. It's a simple way to lift somebody up. It lifts us up. And we have a Facebook page called the Elijah Moment Facebook page. And we encourage people to get involved in creating these Elijah moments wherever you are and share with them on our Facebook page.
So whenever I hear somebody who names a movement or a program after a biblical character, I have to ask the motivations behind that. I'm curious, you know, I'm listening to what an Elijah moment is. And I'm curious if you thought of naming that the Aaron moment, because that seems something more that so, Aaron HaKohen used to do. I'm curious why you chose Elijah.
Why Elijah?
Yeah.
Well, it's in the book, but I'll tell you anyway.
Okay.
It's based upon a story with the Baal Shem Tov. First of all, Elijah does show up, and there are a lot of these sightings where you don't know who Elijah is, and he comes into your life. You may not meet him again, but the story is about a person who goes to the Baal Shem Tov and says, I want to see Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet. And the Baal Shem Tov says, there's a widow in the forest. Bring her food with her for Shabbos to her and her family, and you'll see Elijah. He goes Friday night, Shabbos day, there's no Elijah. Finally, Sunday morning, he still hasn't seen Elijah. He goes to the Baal Shem Tov, and the Baal Shem Tov says, take food again, go back into the forest, and this week you'll see Elijah the prophet. So he goes deep into the forest. He's within earshot of the home, and he hears a child crying out to the mother, saying, Mommy, where are we going to get food from for this Shabbos? And the mother turns to the child and says, just like Elijah came last week, Elijah's going to come again. And then he realized that he was the Elijah that this woman was waiting for. So it's really based on that story. And, you know, Mark Twain, I love this quote. He said, the two most important days of our lives are the day when we're born and the day when we understand why. And the more that we can align ourselves with creating a little more heaven on earth, even with somebody who's just a stranger, and we may never see them again. That's the way that we truly spread Hashem's light in the world. I just read a story today about and Diane shared this with me. It was a Chabad rabbi who was in a subway, and he saw a fellow on the subway without shoes, and he had just bought new sneakers. So he took off his shoes, and he just gave them to this fellow on the subway. And that moment, they'll never see each other again, but that'll be unforgettable for the rest of that person's life.
Phenomenal. Rabbi Cohen, thank you so much for joining me this week. I'm going to see if I could subscribe to your show so I can get it on my podcast list. And I encourage everybody else to do that. Thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate your time, and Hashem should bless the entire mishpacha.
Amen. Thank you. That includes yours. That is a very self-fulfilling bracha right there.
I know. Regards. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
My thanks to Rabbi Cohen for joining me this week. Promoting Shalom is something we can all be better about, and I hope this episode provides enough of a roadmap for you to get started. And by the way, don't be fooled by the last name. Despite his similarities with Aaron HaKohen in his pursuit of peace, Rabbi Cohen is not, in fact, a Kohen. Until next week, Kol Tov.
The Jewish Living Podcast is produced by Sreli Pikus. Our theme song is The Band by A.B. Rottenberg. Follow us on Facebook at The Jewish Living Podcast and on Twitter and Instagram at Jewish_living. You can also email the show at jewishlivingpodcast@gmail.com. The Jewish Living Podcast is recorded in conjunction with the Queens Jewish Link.